Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Dugout Debate Podcast. I'm Tim Hasselbury.
And I'm Chris Kerr.
And we're going to welcome a new full-time member to our podcast, our favourite friend, Jack.
How you doing?
This week, after comments made by the former England rugby star Ben Foden suggesting that rugby and other English sports are leaving their athletes burned out, we discuss what burnout is, how sport in the UK and abroad may exacerbate burnout and lead to more injuries in sport, and which sports are the most guilty of leaving their athletes at risk. So, firstly, we probably better discuss what burnout actually is, because you might think that it's quite an easy thing to contextualise and define, but someone has actually taken the time to define what burnout is in sport, and my personal favourite was by Radhika et al. In 2002. It's my favourite. I spent a lot of time looking these up. And he says that, it is a withdrawal from sport noted by a reduced sense of accomplishment, devaluation and resentment of the sport, and either physical or psychological exhaustion. So that's a lot of nice sciencey words, but what does that actually mean? So, athletes that might be at risk of burnout are the ones who are close to falling into the precipice, if you like. So they might have mood swings, they might struggle to meet their personal and professional obligations to leaving their families in the wilderness a bit, not being able to train and eat right, disappointment and frustration, particularly when things aren't going well on and off the pitch, feeling physically tired, emotional, and difficulty communicating about their problems, and feeling like they receive insufficient support. And the athletes that are on their way, and athletes who have gone all the way to being burned out will be sort of mentally and physically exhausted, unable to perform at the highest level. They may feel isolated, have low concentration, low levels of confidence, and they might feel that their careers are not moving forward and their contribution is not valued. And it's important to recognise the strong psychological element to all of this, but we're going to try and tie it in with a physical element and sort of what state are we leaving athletes in towards the end of their careers. So are they, you know, mentally well, or are they physically capable of living a long, happy life after the end of their careers? Like Chris and I have said before, high-level professional athletic careers might be 10, 15, maybe 20 years tops if you're very lucky, but you know, you still may have over 50 years of your life left to live. So how may burnout lead to a poor quality of life in the future? That's why this is an important thing to discuss. So Chris, Jack and myself have looked out how burnout might occur across a few different sports. We'll start off with the NBA.
Cool. So the NBA recently has seen a massive rise in injuries, and a statistic from last season said that NBA games missed due to injury increased by over 31%, and by some teams' estimations that could rise to 50% in coming seasons. So this really is a massive problem in the NBA, and there are a number of factors that have been looked into by the strength and conditioning teams and the management of each of these the clubs that are suffering these horrific injuries. And one of them was that there's a shorter pre-season. It's not really a shock that 7-foot guys get injured during a 1,230 game NBA season, but the season is now stretched out in an effort to reduce back-to-back games, so that's good that it tries to reduce playing day after day, but it means that the season lasts longer than it ever has done, and it's got rid of shorten the training camp, their version of pre-season at the start of the season, by 7 days, and cut the number of pre-season games that are available, which is useful time for conditioning and regular season prep. So that's definitely a factor to look into, and like most sports, it's also impossible to ignore the fact that all of the sports that we love watching are getting faster and faster and more physical every year, as we see better and better athletes in them. And that's also being blamed as a reason for why more and more injuries are occurring, that they may be playing largely the same amount of games and over pretty much the same period, maybe slightly extended, but the physicality and the speed that they're playing with every single game and in training week in, week out, just means that there's more wear and tear on those players. And despite all of the injuries, the TV ratings were up actually for the NBA last season, just to show that people's appetite for the game isn't there just for watching the big stars, even if they're injured. It's always there, and that may be a factor that we're going to be looking into later as to what's causing these games to be played over a longer period.
Yep, a lot of good points there. I think the point you made about training being more ferocious and the athletes involved being more fast, more powerful, that sort of thing are very, very fair points. This is definitely something we're going to keep visiting in the rest of this podcast. But Jack, how about football?
Yeah, very similar in terms of the time of their spending in terms of training and the fact that players are coming, becoming bigger and better athletes. But we're also seeing the football seasons are getting longer as well. And I use the Barclays Premier League as probably the best example to see the effect of burnout. Because on average, teams in the Premier League have around, Premier League and other tournaments that they play in, around 50 to 60 games a season. That's not including any internationals that some players may play in. So obviously we've had the World Cup this summer as well, which, obviously adds up to the amount of games that these guys play. And I actually thought a good example was N'Golo Kante, who plays for Chelsea, who, as we all know, is one of the fittest players that play football. I found it quite interesting that he played 59 games that year. But what was crazy was that his season started on the 6th of August 2017 and only technically finished on the World Cup final on the 15th of July 2018. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, nearly the whole year, his whole season, he had a couple of weeks off technically, where he was probably expected to go back into pre-season. But obviously with the high amounts of appearances that they're having, it does equate to having a very high amount of injuries throughout the year. And in the 2017-28 season, there was an average of 57.5 injuries per team for the year, and 25.7 weeks where they lasted over 2 weeks of an injury, which I think is absolutely crazy. This is quite common when it comes to certain months in the year. As you can imagine, the fixture congestion kind of builds up at certain points in the year, which doesn't really help. Most notably January in the Premier League, where you start to get the fixture congestion of the FA Cup, and you've got the winter games, where they start to play every three or so days. This is quite uncommon in terms of any other international leagues, where you normally get an international break in the Spanish and the German leagues, where players are expected but also get that time to switch off and kind of build up their energy to get back into it again. So the Premier League, the players are quite unlucky for that, and it doesn't help the players at all.
Of course, we do have that winter break now, which will be nice, a nice staggered
yes,
winter break.
Yes, it should be a nice change.
That'll be interesting to see how it works, because I think the way it's structured, we won't actually lose our great festive period sort of football stuff, but certain teams get a break for a week, and then the following week, the other teams will get a break. So there is a nice actual
It's a break over 2 weeks in February. It's not this next, it's not this season, but the season after 2019-20.
Yeah, but still, it looks like they're actually looking after their players a bit. Chuck, a couple of points that I wanted to pick up. I think you and I both read the same physio room thing on injuries and that sort of stuff. The spike in January was interesting, but more pertinent to this podcast, I thought that the April-May spike was also quite interesting. Because in April and May, there aren't actually that many fixtures, are there? They tend to be weekly with the build-up because, you know, all the TV channels are trying to get that hype before the match. So, yeah, it could be evidence that burnout is actually happening in some of the athletes. Maybe not so much psychological burnout, but physical burnout. You know, these athletes are running lows and lows every day throughout the season. Are the coaches of each of these clubs and tapering their training correctly to be able to sort of go through that end of the season and mitigate any potential of picking up injuries and that sort of thing. And another point I wanted to make, which was based on the fact that you just, as soon as you said 60 games in N'Golo Kante, I immediately thought of when Leicester won the title. And of course, the following year, Chelsea won the title, having absolutely bottled it and come 10th or something like that, hadn't they? And of course, the two things those teams share in common is the fact that they didn't... N'Golo Kante. Yeah. Let me finish. And the fact that they didn't play in Europe. So, you know, when they were put under pressure by Tottenham towards the end of their respective seasons, the fact that they hadn't played in Europe, the fact that they didn't have to change their team very much, both teams had a very settled starting 11s towards the back end of both of those seasons, meant that they could keep up that consistency and get the points, not drop them and not succumb to the pressure that came. So I think that despite the fact that we're not talking about injuries and we don't tend to talk about injuries in title winning seasons, I think they're very important. And then as a as a subsidy of that, then also burnout has to be considered an important factor to consider when champions are made. You know, who can be the most consistent, who tapers their training correctly, who keeps their athletes motivated for long enough, and who avoids burnout for the longest. So I went on and had a look at rugby. I actually did a little comparison of a couple of seasons about 15 years apart, so back in the early days of the professional rugby era, and last season. So we'll go back to 2002-2003, and just as an example, we'll take Northampton Saints, because they played the most matches, essentially. So they made it to playoffs in the Premiership and reached the quarterfinal of the Heineken Cup. So they played 22 Premiership games, 7 European games, and 4 Power Gen Cup games. And over the time frame of the season, they were also 10 internationals. Therefore, an integral player for Saints and England team, such as Matt Dawson, could in theory have played 43 matches. Granted, I'll just caveat that with the fact that England games occur throughout the Premiership season rather than a dedicated international break, so it's unlikely that he would have played every single game, especially in the Cups. But, you know, I'm being fanciful for a reason. It just makes the maths easier and that sort of thing. So assuming he played every game for about 60 of the 80 minutes, assuming he gets subbed off at some point, he would have played around 2,500 minutes. If we go forward to the 2017-18 season, Saracens played 22 Premiership games, just like Northampton, 4 cup games, 7 European games, so far no different. There were 12 internationals this time, so that's 2 extra international fixtures, plus a full Lions tour consisting of 10 matches. Therefore, an integral player for all those teams would theoretically play 55 matches a season, and therefore he would have played around 3,300 minutes. Granted, the maths and the logic are a little bit warped, but I think, you know, almost 800 minutes extra a season, that's going to take its toll on you. And then we're not going to forget that, you know, the brutality and the physicality of the modern game is a lot higher standard than it was back 15 years ago. Sports science has moved on a long way. You're getting these absolute powerhouses where, you know, the average forward is well over 6 foot. Combined with more intensive training programs and reduced recovery periods could well lead to more severe injuries. So some research by the RFU, this is a really good little well, it's not a little read, it's a pretty mammoth read, but we'll put it on our website anyway. I've shown that since 2003, the number of days missed per injury has risen from 16 days to 31 days, which is pretty staggering. That's basically double, 16 days to 31 days. And you've got to remember that it's not just an athlete issue. This is a money issue as well. And rugby is, while it's going up the ladder in terms of how much money it can accrue, 31 days of a professional rugby player's salary, especially if they're one of your stars, is a big hit to be losing for no return. So this is, you know, likely due to a number of factors, including injuries with greater severity, but also the 16 to 31 days, you've got to remember that there's going to be better detection of things like concussions. So players are now being brought out of the game for longer deliberately to ensure that the players return healthy. So it's not just the fact that there are more injuries, but we're also getting better at making sure athletes are getting fully fit before they return. Also, in the 16-17 season, compared to the averages of 2002 to 2016, so there's a longer average period compared to the 16-17 season, obviously, there were more injury incidences per 1,000 hours in every month excluding March, with an alarming increase in April and May, so again towards the end of the season. So this is something that I've picked up in a few of the articles I've read, that there seems to be a big batch of injuries happening right at the end of the season, just as it's ending, so suggesting that burnout is actually becoming more of an issue than it was in the past. So maybe it was that consistent level of play throughout a season was manageable back in the early days of professional sport, but now in the most recent stages, the pile up of fixtures in the winter period and later on is really taking an effect on the athletes at the end of the season. Right, that's probably enough speaking from me. So Chris, what do you think the driving factors for the increased number of games and increased season lengths are?
So the obvious two that I came up with without even having to look at any sort of factors elsewhere and that most people would think of anyway off the top of their heads were fans wanting to watch as much of their favourite sport as they could as possible over as long a period as possible and as many games of it as possible. And the second being TV demands as well, which has seen many sports be warped with fixtures on Thursdays, Fridays, Monday nights and no longer the traditional weekend fixtures, which means that backing up from games on a weekend means you can be playing another 3 days later in sports such as rugby league, more manageable in football just because of the type of sport that it is and because of the larger squads that they can rotate. But if you're trying to play rugby 3 days apart from each other, I'm sure anyone that's done any sort of rugby training will know that that's pretty damn impossible, because your body's just not going to be right for that, and you're not going to be able to do the training required either. But I also thought it was interesting that the actual number of regular season games in pretty much all of the sports that we've looked at has stayed relatively similar for a number of years. So I looked at two big American sports. I looked at Major League Baseball, who have been playing a mammoth 162 games a season since 1961, and the NBA has been playing a huge 82 games a season since 1967-68. And the Premier League, although the players that play in the Premier League, if they're playing in Europe and in the cup competitions as well, may end up playing 50 or 60 games, as Jack's already said. Obviously, it's a 38 game season on its own in the Premier League, and that's stayed the same since 1992 when the Premier League first came in. So it's not that the actual number of games in a lot of these sports has gone up. The actual number of games that they're playing seems to be pretty much the same for all of those leagues. But it's what I factored in was it's the increased number of international games or the increased high profile international preseason friendlies that have really added matches and also extended the calendar. So the examples of this are the NBA Africa Games that we've had recently and the International Champions Cup football that we've had in the US as our preseason, which has obviously come straight after the World Cup as well. So it seemed like there really hasn't been a break for any of those guys. And I thought it was worth adding in at this point that the World Cup are looking to expand for the 2026 World Cup from 32 teams to 48. So that's just going to make it worse from that side of things with international sport, again, impinging on the club game. And as Tim mentioned in his rugby analysis, there's an extra two more international rugby games in the calendar when you're comparing the 2002-2003 season to the one we've just had. So it does appear that the demand for the highest end of the sport, which is normally the international side of it, means that fans want a demanding more international sport and offering huge amounts of money to go and play these International Champions Cup fixtures in the US, which they wouldn't normally get to see. But that is definitely contributing to burnout and has even led to talk of this mythical 39th Premier League game idea, which when we look at burnout seems pretty impossible, but the Premier League chief execs etc. might try and make it work just for the money, because I'm sure that's going to be a huge money spinner.
Just explain what that is, Chris.
So they're looking at possibly, having mentioned that they've played 38 games since the start of the inception of the Premier League, they're looking at playing a 39th fixture against a derby team, I think they said it was going to be originally, so it was going to be a big game, a Liverpool, Man United and Arsenal, Spurs, that kind of thing, abroad. They were going to take it to the US or take it to China or take it to Australia, wherever the markets really wanted it and were willing to pay big bucks for. They were going to get all of the teams to play an extra game just for that money. So yeah, that's definitely another thing to take into account, and it seems that money's talking when it comes to these sorts of things. And the final bit I wanted to talk about was, I've just done a bit of research on the length of seasons for various sports around the world. And having already mentioned the NBA and Major League Baseball, the NBA season runs from October to June, with the April to June being the playoffs in that. And as I mentioned in my previous section, that's extended by a week already, and there's already talks of it growing further and further. And obviously, basketball's affected by the Olympics, etc. So there is very little time off now with Summer League and all other things that take place in basketball for players to actually get time off, and rookies straight out of college to get time off as well. And the Major League Baseball started the earliest it ever has done this season. It started back on March the 29th and is due to end this season on September the 30th, the regular season, with the World Series taking place in October. So that season seems to be getting longer and longer, with 162 games per club, as I've mentioned, and an absolutely mammoth 2,430 games total in Major League Baseball. Boy, do the Americans love baseball. And so moving back from the US to Actually, no, still staying in the US for one more sport, which we'll probably look at later, at one of the best sports for burnout, and one that was mentioned by Ben Foden in his article. No coincidence, really, because he's moving to go and play rugby in America himself. But he mentioned the NFL, which takes place just from September to February, with a pre-season in August, and January to February being the playoffs. That's an incredibly short season compared to pretty much all of the others that we're looking at here. And it would be interesting, it would take far more time than we all have to do a full study on it. But to see whether the impact of injuries compared to NFL players, compared to rugby, etc., due to burnout, was different because their season is so much shorter. But I thought the only other thing to look at was when the season was going to take place. So Premiership Rugby takes this year is due to be from the September the 1st to June the 1st, with May being the playoffs and the Premiership final being on June the 1st itself. And Super League, the rugby league equivalent in the UK, moved from being a winter sport to a summer sport, and that moved to being from February to October. So I thought it'd be interesting to look at how the effect of heat, etc., would be on that. And also, as I've mentioned previously, Super League's also at the beck and call of Sky, really, who pay all of the money towards that make them play on these Thursday night and Monday night games. So it'd be interesting to see the impact on two fairly similar sports, both being rugby, but both playing at very different times and at very different schedules now, as to what's happened to them.
There's a few things from that, like, it's a good, really good summary, Chris. First thing is, you know, I work like a good job. You know, I do quite a lot during the day. It's quite active. And I need a break. I need a holiday. I've just been to Cyprus and I feel refreshed and happy, and I only had 10 days off. But these guys are working really hard throughout the season. You know, they're pushing their bodies to the limit and that sort of thing. Think of poor Harry Kane running around for England with no great avail in the knockouts, to be fair to him. He didn't rescore me. but, you know, he's had, what, 2 weeks off, 3 weeks off, pretty much. And now he's going to another full Premier League season. That's not enough break. It's just not enough. It's crazy. These people aren't robots. They're, you know, human beings. And bear in mind that his summer break will have been, you know, a few days away, somewhere nice and hot, but training every day to make sure he doesn't put on any weight and that sort of thing. So in reality, yeah, they never get time off, do they?
That's a key point. Exactly. They now get tested when they come in for pre-season. Yeah, they're not allowed to have any time off. They have to go into the gym in whatever fancy hotel they go to in Ibiza or wherever it might be around the world. They still have to be training every single day. And I can attest, as someone that works in Premiership Rugby for a club, it's brutal just the season itself and not doing all the fitness stuff on top of it. The week after week, giving up pretty much every single weekend to go and play the games is mentally tough enough on its own, let alone then having to add all the physical load of actually playing the game and not just writing some tweets about it. It's a huge, huge task for all of those guys.
And I think that's why we're seeing, for example, Sale in the Premiership, Steve Diamond has come out saying that his team doesn't actually do contact training now throughout the week, and I think that helps them a hell of a lot in terms of their coming back from injuries or looking after their bodies throughout that time. And it's just seeing how other teams now react to that, because these guys are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and the season's getting longer and longer. Teams are having to react in different ways to just keep their squads fit.
It's now impossible to try and get the amount of training that I think all the coaches would want them to have. They're literally managing the players so that they can go from game to game, really, and it's the only real quality time that they get, and it's being cut, as we've already talked about, is pre-season. The only real time they get to go through the moves with the players. I remember Jurgen Klopp, when he first came in midway through the season, said, you're going to see a very different Liverpool team the season after, because I'm actually going to have a pre-season with them to tell them what I want them to do, because week to week I've only got 3 days between games and that's not giving me enough time. We're just managing them and trying to get them through the season, really. So yeah, it's definitely a case of not being able to do contact in rugby and not being able to do the stuff that they want on the training pitch.
So, okay, in that case, could a potential solution be just having games throughout the week, Jack? So every day, every other day, but then spacing out the teams more fairly so they're consistent, but there's a good break in between each match.
Well, I think this really depends on the sport, because the duration of rest that these guys need obviously differs for each sport. I think it's unlikely that we're going to have another sport that has the likes of 82 games in one season, like basketball, obviously. And the fact that those guys are able to do that shows you how physically fit these guys are. So obviously I think it's unlikely. We're already having certain players and managers coming out saying that the season's already too long in some sports. I think a great example was, I think it was 6 months ago, Billy Vunipola actually came out saying that he would happily take a pay cut to play less games throughout the season.
Yeah.
And players that are that big in the sport that they play in coming out and saying that they would happily take less money when they're on obviously large amounts of money to play less games shows that they're obviously going to want, they think they'll be able to be more productive throughout the season if it was shorter or if it was managed better. The way that America does it, obviously, in certain sports is that they have their own conferences, which I think would work in certain things. But again, I still think their season's a bit too long. And another example, as Chris has already outlined, Jurgen Klopp, when he first came into the Premier League, he is open about the fact that he thinks the season is too long. And obviously, with the Premier League having no winter break, obviously, this is going to change. He said it was very unlikely that we're going to see many English teams competing in worldwide tournaments at the highest level. Obviously, you get the odd exception, but because of the seasons, the way that their season is broken down, it doesn't really work. So, yeah, back to the question, it depends on what the sport is. If it's a physically demanding sport, I think they need the longer periods, and I think it's more likely that we'd see it go into the NFL route, where it's a shorter season and less games, than going into the baseball or basketball way.
The alternative to bring up on what you've just said there is exactly what Klopp's done. He's not going to be able to change the amount of games or the breaks himself, because obviously that's down to the administrators in the game. What he's done is controlled what he can control, and he's made Liverpool's squad two or three times the size of what it was when he first came in, so that he can rotate his players a lot more, particularly with the style of play that he likes to play with, his pressing style. It takes a hell of a lot out of the players. So he realised in his first season, and it took him that first season at Liverpool to realise it, that he wasn't going to be able to play that style with the limited number of players that he had, just playing the same 11 week in, week out. He had to get a bigger squad. He had to rotate more. So maybe if the administrators aren't going to change the game, then it's a case that these sports are just going to have to look at getting bigger and bigger squads and rotate their players more and more and end up just playing the stars for the big matches.
Exactly. And just to add to that, obviously the more games that are getting played, it's generating even more and more money from the TV companies. So as you said, it's probably the best way for them to counteract this as a problem is by making their squads bigger with the money that they are generating from more TV games or playing games internationally, like you said, Tim. And I think France, the French Rugby League, is making a slight change in the way that their playing squads are getting to it. And I think they're having more, the sub bench is a lot bigger. And I think that on its own, making sure that the squads that these teams play with are a lot bigger, should have less of an impact on players in terms of how many minutes they're playing, or less demand, making the body less hurt, really.
Yeah, particularly in rugby, I'd like to see a minimum number of people that you can have in a squad. Coming from the Premiership rugby angle, it's no coincidence that Saracens and Exeter are doing fantastically well season after season, because they have the biggest squads. They have over 50 players in their squad, whereas teams like Wasps have had under 40 people last season, and this season will have 44. So there is a change, and people are definitely realising that that's the way to go.
That does sort of, like you say, it depends on the sport. I mean, football is already constricted by the fact that you can only have 25 players in a Premier League squad. Granted, you know, homegrown players and that sort of thing are, you know, changed the rules ever so slightly. But okay, say you're Jurgen Klopp, you can only really get a 25-man squad. And I know Liverpool actually do struggle with getting the homegrown contingents. Their squad could actually be smaller because they haven't got enough players who have been brought up in this country. So
it's not the physical numbers that he's changed. It's probably the quality of the people within the squad.
No, I totally see that. Yeah, 100%. I see that. But then at the same point, if we look at Leicester and we look at Chelsea, the most successful teams are the ones that don't change a lot. Yeah. So are we sacrificing the competition by making the seasons longer because teams now playing a particular style of football, rugby, whatever, are having to get more players who may not be of the best quality that necessarily the top stars in the team are, but that can do a job.
I guess that
to ensure that you have fewer injuries.
It changes the style of management, doesn't it? It means that someone like Jurgen Klopp's going to be a cup team because his team's only going to be able to raise to that level with that number of players for a small amount of games, whereas a different style of play under a different manager is much better suited for a league campaign.
So would you take winning the Champions League but getting relegated?
Yeah, I know. That's what you've got to do, and that's the conundrum with choosing that type of manager.
That's what I mean. With the playing squads, we're also seeing teams that, as you're saying, Jurgen Klopp's looking for players that are more likely to be fit for the longer period of the season so that he's got a wider squad that are more available. But and then we're seeing the other way that teams are going. And unfortunately, I'm an Arsenal fan at the moment, but you see the likes of Jack Wilshere and Santi Cazorla get this year. They've come off quite bad injury records, and Arsenal have actually now released them and gone for players that may not be as technically gifted as those two, because they are two of the most gifted players, but they're not available a lot of the time because they suffer with the amount of games that are played throughout the season.
That's going back to player welfare, isn't it? Because they're not being treated correctly almost in that way. They're being brutally treated because they suffer from burnout. They're being criticised and they're being done badly out of the situation simply because they can't deal with playing that number of games. They're fantastic athletes, they're fantastic footballers, but they simply can't play that number of games, and it means that clubs are getting rid of them for someone that can do it.
Jack, I'm afraid to say that you're an Arsenal fan for life, not just for the moment. So, No, the points you boys make are compelling. I love sport, we all do, but we're not going to say this is going to be the death of it. And I'm actually going to put a positive spin on it. Me and my fellow brethren in the undergraduate world of sports science, it's still a fledgling discipline. And I think that the big obsession in sports science has been for the last 15, 20 years, where can we get the marginal gains? Where can we make improvements to make our team that little bit better to excel and win titles? But now sports science, is it going to start be looking as a, okay, we've got this set of athletes and they've got to do all this brutal punishment for 8-9 months of an intense season, have time off. How best can we use the knowledge that these physiologists, these expert exercise physiologists that we have, how can we utilize their knowledge to make sure that the season is prolonged for everyone, there are fewer injuries as possible? And then obviously on the physio side of things, the prehab, all the preventative measures that they have, so that I kind of believe that all the strong research that's happening in the field will sort of push sports science into sort of a different stratosphere in terms of the expertise that's required in elite sport. And this actually relates quite well to another podcast, Education to Sport, that one of our friends from school also runs. It's really good, check it out, I will link to it. There's the jobs available for sports scientists are very difficult to come by in elite sport because they're always asking for people with 2 to 3, 4, 5 years of experience in that level. And like Pochettino said in his book, how can you get experience if no one's willing to give it to you? So you've got this huge pool of very talented, clever people who can't get experience anywhere. They can't get voluntary experience anywhere because all these clubs shut their doors. And what do you find elite as? Is League 2 level, or is it Premier League level? Or is it Premiership level rugby, or is it like Division 1 level rugby? There are lots of people who are waiting for their opportunities, who are very intelligent, they know their physiology, they know how to bring these things into sport. So I think that's a good, exciting future for the future of sports science and the future of, sport itself. Can we get athletes who are determined to get through a season injury-free and are able to carry that through physiologically and psychologically? And coming off the back of that, Jack, you've had a look at examples of athletes who have retired due to burnout or injury and attributed their retirement to the excess demands of sport.
Yeah, funny enough, I've with the three sports that we chose at the start, I've got examples from each three. Most notably, I think the biggest one that's come out recently was Sam Warburton, who's obviously a huge name, ex-Wales captain. He's toured with the Lions twice. And he's unfortunately retired at the age of 29. And it wasn't just one injury that ended his career in a sense. he's had multiple injuries all over his body, and it's just kind of got to the end for him, which is a real shame. The other rugby boy that I chose was Alex Corbusiera, who was he's an England prop and line prop as well. He unfortunately had to retire at 27, which is very young, especially for a prop. But he had niggling shoulder and knee injuries that pretty much caused him to retire. He said he was actually going to take a sabbatical, and he now works in the sports industry in America. But it's very unlikely that he's now going to come back, considering he's in probably a dream job for himself. In football, I thought two good examples, they've both been retired for a while now, would be Ledley King, who is arguably one of the best centre-backs to have come out of England. But unfortunately, he was only able to play 20 games for England. He had a very, very short career in terms of football, which was unbelievably unlucky for him, because the likes of Thierry Henry came out saying he was the best defender that he ever played against. And it was a huge shame. He himself had chronic knee injuries and just they kept on building up. The other footballer I chose was Owen Hargreaves as well. So Owen Hargreaves is probably one of the only players that successfully had an impact outside of English football when he was over at Bayern Munich. He was an unbelievable footballer again. Only played 40 games, but he had recurring injuries throughout his career, as all of these guys have. And again, it was a real shame that he finished. In terms of NBA, you see a lot of basketball players' careers that last longer than most because they can. They're bigger and they're bulkier and they can have short stints and still have an impact. But the biggest name that came out of China for basketball was Yao Ming. And he was a global superstar and still is. He unfortunately had to retire at the age of 30 due to foot injuries, which was huge. He was an unbelievable player, and we did not want to see him finish his career. The final one that I came up with hasn't actually finished his career yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't last much longer because he's had a horrible injury record, and that is Derrick Rose. Derrick Rose was drafted as the number one draft in 2008 and made it to be MVP in 2011, which if you look in hindsight is crazy with the other athletes like LeBron James and everyone that's been around to compete at that level is unbelievable. But the year after he was MVP, he tore his ACL. And ever since he's pretty much struggled to come back and have an impact in the NBA. He still is in the NBA at the moment, but it wouldn't surprise me if he finishes his career soon.
Yep, lots of good examples there. There are quite a few people who I'm just thinking off the top of my head, though. Not quite a few, but they're special athletes who have had all these setbacks in their career, but they've always found a will and a way to come back. Vincent Kompany jumps into my head. He's just perpetually injured. Like, he's always injured to me, but then comes back right when his team needs him, gets crucial goals from centre-back and performs really well. Johnny Wilkinson, the legend, you know, his career was plagued with injuries, but he always came back. So I think it's that steely determination that can really help avoid burnout in the psychological sense, but obviously you can't really necessarily avoid it in the physical sense if that's the way that the sporting world is structured. Chris, I think you've already touched on which sports are the best at providing the athletes with rest periods. I think we've already said the NFL has a strong 5 months off between season and pre-season, post-season and pre-season. The NBL, that's also got 5 months. And then the ones that are the worst, granted, golf is not exactly the most, what should we say?
Physically tasking.
Yeah. Physically demanding of sports. That's the one. Yeah. Sorry to all your golfers, but I mean, if you've got Juan Angel or whatever his name, the big Spaniard who smokes fat cigars, Jimenez, if he can do that, then I think it's a valid point. Technically, the European Golf Tour has no months off, in theory.
Wow, I didn't know that.
But, you know, you pick and choose when you play your games.
Yeah.
And the ATP World Tour only has 1 month off, again, in theory. Obviously, the major season is a little bit more condensed.
Yeah.
But, if you want to earn that money, and it's more, you know, we're not just talking about the upper echelons of sport. We're also talking about the pros who aren't world beaters. And, you know, these guys might want to play in every single tournament they can.
Yeah,
so it's structured unfairly to them.
Yeah.
You know, are they, because they haven't got the money for the coaches and that sort of thing, and they haven't got the all the backing in the first place. Are they sacrificing their career by playing too much to get the money to pay the coaches and all that sort of thing? Would it be fairer to play a fewer number of games but eligible for only specific ranks? Do you see where I'm getting at with this?
Yeah. Golf and tennis are both brutal on that, aren't they? To be able to keep the money that you need to stay on tour, you need to, if you're not winning tournaments, so you're not getting top tens, you do need to play a hell of a lot of tournaments to sustain it.
Exactly.
And keeping your seed up just to get into tournaments as well.
Yeah.
Exactly. And obviously, football generally is pretty bad. Players in the Premier Division have only had a couple of weeks off if they reach the last stages of the World Cup. But I think we've spoken plenty about burnout. So hopefully everyone's learned a little bit about what burnout is, how bad it can be for athletes' careers, what sort of problems it can lead to. But also, I like to think that we've infused many little sports scientists who are going to run and get their jobs with.
That's what we need, eh, Tim? Clubs. We need them to be the administrators of the game, and then they know what they're talking about.
Exactly. Well, you know, there is a little bit of reluctance to big administrators in various sports to listen to experts. I think generally this is a thing people don't do. They don't listen to experts in the field. They just decide to ignore it. But we'll put it into sport context. And, you know, for years and years, this concussion drum was being banged. And only recently, when we've had big problems with it, have governing bodies gone, oh, no, concussion. And it's the same thing with this sort of thing. You know, how long is it going to be until, you know, our biggest sports stars are retiring at 26 just because they can't handle it anymore? So, you know, hopefully sports science will just conquer the world. That's what I'm saying.
Again, it will take the big instances, won't it? The big public figures, just like we've started to see the stuff coming into football with headers and concussion and that. It's going to take a couple of big high-profile players. I mean, Wayne Rooney's not retired. He's gone to America, which is the equivalent of retiring. But he's burnt out at 32 because he's been playing since he's 16 in the Premier League week in, week out. And he's got the body of probably an over 35-year-old. It is those kind of examples with Sam Warburton and Corbusiera, as you've already mentioned. In cricket, we had Marcus Trescothick and Jonathan Trott, who both couldn't keep up the lifestyle needed to go on tour with England, and they couldn't deal with
that. That was big mentally with those two.
Yeah.
It was the mental side. You know, I think different sports lead to different types of burnout, and that's a particularly good example of mental burnout. Like, you've got to be so self-assured and confident in your ability to be a good batsman, a good bowler, and when you crack and you're gone, you know, that getting the jips in golf as well. You know, it's
not just physical, as you say, it's all mental as well.
But we're not trying to be unrealistic here and say, you know, everyone's going to have a big 15-year career and, you know, that we want them to carry on forever. Not everyone is going to make it for a long time, but you want the athletes who can perform well to play for as long as they can at that level before they sort of naturally decline, which is why I think Rooney is a sort of different kind of example, because I think that his decline has been quite natural, whereas some people have fallen off a cliff.
His just started early. Yeah,
you know where I'm getting at. So his was shifted leftwards on the time continuum, if you know what I'm saying. Yeah, but we don't want people dropping off a cliff, like Santi Cazorla, who went to nothing very quickly, you know, player. So that sort of thing. Another person I'd quite like to answer is Becky Adlington. She did everything, didn't she, in swimming and then left. You know, that's an example of burnout. You know, swimming 4 o'clock in the morning, going to school, all that sort of thing from a very early age. That's tough. I don't want to do that. I couldn't be bothered rowing with 5 o'clock in the morning once a week.
That's a very good sport to bring up, actually, Timmy, because they have the youngest career out of anyone, really. They last only about 5 or 6 years and stop, unless you're someone like Michael Phelps and are obsessed by winning gold till you're really old.
But we're talking about swimming, right?
Yeah, swimming. They all start really, really young and normally only have a 4 or 5 year career and then stop because it's just too grueling.
Yeah, it's hard. I'm a full kudos to all athletes, especially swimmers.
Yeah,
I'm very bad swimmer. So, I think we'll end it there. Thanks very much for that, boys. Obviously, we've got quite a lot of extra reading, I think, from this. I've certainly got a few things, Jack and Chris. Hopefully, Jack, you've been saving your stuff as you go along. Or not, you can do some good old long history searching, but don't leave the extracurriculars. Don't put those on there. Anyway, thank you very much, chaps.
Cheers to me. Thank you.
Don't forget to follow us on all our social media stuff at @dugout_debate on the Facebook and Twitter. We'll try and get more on it with social media, I think. Let's do more social media-y stuff. Get involved, ask us questions. If you think that we're talking rubbish and sports fine the way it is, you know, athletes have paid for this, then fine, let us know. We're happy to have a chat. All right, guys, have a good time.
Have a good time.
Thanks, everyone.
See you later.
Bye.
Cheers.